poor little E.T. was asked to call home. But should he have sent a letter instead? New research this week suggests that parcel post, rather than radio, is the most sensible way of communicating with extraterrestrial civilizations across the voids of deep space.
For large messages, you might want to pack into essentially a little kit bag and literally, this is the funny part, toss it to the destination, even if the destination is tens of thousands of light years away.
And a starring role in a nail-biting space drama for a guy from the glitzy world of Hollywood movies.
I've been in The Incredible Hulk, I've been in the movie SWAT, and also Charlie's Angels.
The stuntman charged with saving a multi-million dollar science mission from a fatally heavy landing next week. All that and more in the next 20 minutes or so on a Spaced Out Science in Action from the BBC with me, Dee Palmer. There's been a breakthrough in the search for planets beyond our own solar system. Several teams have just announced the discovery of exoplanets, as they're called, that are much smaller than anything that's been found before. And that brings us closer to finding planets like the Earth, ones which might even harbour life. Of course, the astronomers searching for exoplanets can't actually see them because they're so far away. So what they look for is a wobble in a star, a tiny change in its velocity caused by the gravitational pull of the planet that circles it. From the wobble of the star, the scientists can work out the size of the planet and its orbit, but not much more. Even so, the latest discoveries are enough to get the astronomers very excited. After the announcement of the findings of two American teams, Alan Boss, a theoretical astrophysicist at the Carnegie Institution in Washington, told me why the new exoplanets are so important.
We seem to have evidence now for a very different class of planet compared to what's been discovered so far. We've so far found over 100 planets which we think are gas giants, similar to Jupiter and Saturn. And Jupiter is, of course, the king of our solar system. It has a mass 318 times the mass of our Earth. Saturn has around 95 Earth masses. But what's been discovered this week and announced are several planets which have masses more like the mass of Uranus and Neptune, the two ice giant planets in our solar system. So they have masses on the order of 10 or 20 times, in that range, times the mass of the Earth, which puts them in a range where we think that they may be ice giant planets like Uranus and Neptune, but we really don't know exactly what they are. We just know their masses. We don't know what their compositions are.
When you say an ice giant, what do you mean, Alan?
Well, Uranus and Neptune, we know from modeling their interiors, are primarily composed of ice with a bit of rock and a relatively small amount of hydrogen and helium gas as an envelope around them. And so they're basically giant planets which are made out of primarily ice. That's as opposed to the gas giant planets, Jupiter and Saturn, which have a much smaller amount of rock and ice, but a very large amount of hydrogen and helium gas. And so they're referred to as gas giants. So those are the two main types of planets in our solar system in some sense. If one was looking at it from the outside, those are the big guys you would see first. Of course, the ones we're most interested in are the Earth-like planets, terrestrial planets, like Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, which are composed primarily of rock.
But because they're smaller, presumably they're a lot harder to see.
Exactly. Harder to see in any way of detecting them. They are very tough to define, and that's why we haven't found any yet, even though people have been trying very hard.
But even so, the discovery of this new class, these possibly ice-rock mixtures, it kind of extends the planetary zoo, doesn't it?
It does indeed. It's very reassuring because it tells us that our own solar system can be used to some extent to predict what to find elsewhere. We didn't really know ahead of time what other planetary systems would look like at all, and so it's somewhat reassuring to see that, yes, there are indeed planets in this mass range orbiting other stars. Although these planets are not, of course, similar to our ice giants from the point of view of their orbital properties. These planets are orbiting very, very close to their star. They're well within Mercury's orbit. They're so close to the star, they're really just maybe less than 10 times the star's radius away. They're very close, and so they're very hot. In that sense, they're not like our ice giants.
Coincidentally, or perhaps not, at the end of last week, another group, European this time, announced that they found a planet with 14 times the bulk of the Earth, circling close round a star which is like our own sun. So it's slightly smaller than the Americans' discoveries. Also, this team believe that this planet first formed very close to its star, and so it's unlikely to be an ice giant. D Didier Collot is one of the scientists who used a new instrument at the European Southern Observatory in Chile to find this planet. So if it's not ice, what is it made of?
The best educated guess that we can do on this planet, from what we understand of the planetary formation, is the planet must be rocky. It's big rocky planets with some atmosphere, would be hydrogen, possibly helium and other gas. But it's really very different from this, what we call the gas giants or ice giants.
So if it's a rocky planet, it's somewhat more like Earth than any planet that's been discovered so far.
Well, that's the jump I would not do. In between a planet like the Earth and a planet like giant planets, and that's probably the most exciting point, is we are in this kind of gray area where we have no counterpart in the solar system. And that's why we decided to call it a kind of super Earth, just to try to explain that it's more massive.
So if it were possible to stand on the surface, I guess I'd be feeling very heavy and the sun would be absolutely enormous in the sky.
Yes, you would guess true. I mean, the gravity is 2 times the gravity of the Earth. It's not too bad. But what would be very bad is the fact you are extremely close to its sun. The temperature on the surface of this planet would be above 600 degrees centigrade. And of course, there is the one face which is dark and one face which is on the sun face. And I mean, the atmosphere would be, the wind would be crazy. And anyway, this would not definitely be the right place to stay. I would not recommend this planet.
How did you actually find this? Because I gather you were using some new instruments to look for planets.
Yes. A few years ago, the European Southern Observatory decided to have a very specific instrument that should be, in a sense, a breakthrough compared to what has been done before. And we just by observing what we have been detecting so far, you can extrapolate. And if object just a couple times the mass of the Earth exists on short orbit, this dream machine can definitely detect them.
Didier Collot of the Geneva Observatory in Switzerland. You're listening to Science in Action on the BBC World Service. I'm Dee Palmer. And still to come, the best way of sending a message to alien civilizations. Genesis space probe was launched 3 years ago, with little fanfare. But in its own quiet way, it could yield as much information about our own solar system as other, better publicised missions. Genesis has been hovering between the Earth and the Sun, collecting a sample of the solar wind, the atoms that are ejected from the Sun and flow out way beyond Pluto. Now the probe is on its way home, with its precious cosmic cargo, which is eagerly awaited by the scientists who are going to analyse it. Gareth Mitchell has been speaking to a team based just outside London who'll be among the first to get their hands on the fruits of the Genesis mission.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, we have ignition, and we have liftoff of NASA's Genesis spacecraft on a mission to retrieve a piece of the sun.
Well, that's Genesis blasting off at the beginning of its mission back in 2001. Well, 3 years on, here I am at the Open University with Colin Pillinger, who's head of the Planetary and Space Sciences Research Institute. Now, Colin, let's be absolutely clear about what Genesis is bringing back. We're not talking about grains of dust here, particles that are altogether much smaller.
Yeah, we're talking about individual atoms of all the elements which occur naturally in the periodic table. The sun, the solar corona, is so hot that the electrons are actually stripped off all the atoms that exist there. They flow out from the sun all the time, such that they reach Earth after several days. But if you expose a collector somewhere between Earth and sun, then you can pick up and record these particles. They're very, very tenuous. That means there's not many atoms there. But if you sit around and wait for 2 years, then, of course, you can accumulate all those atoms. So this is the most comprehensive sample of the solar system that there has ever been.
Well, that clicking noise you can hear in the background is a high-power laser doing its thing in one of the labs where the samples will come for analysis. And one of the first people to get his hands on them will be Colin's colleague here in the lab, Ian Frankie. Ian, how exactly is Genesis collecting all these atoms?
in a series of collectors that will be displayed to the sun, collecting the solar wind particles for the 2-year duration of the collection mission.
So these are effectively kind of wafers of diamond or silicon or whatever?
Yes, for each element there's a specific type of collector material. Carbon will be collected in ultra-pure silicon wafers. The oxygen analysis will be done on diamond film for this analysis.
As far as oxygen is concerned, the facility we're standing in now is going to be one of the places where you're going to be looking at different kinds of oxygen then. So what's the significance there?
Well, oxygen, and particularly the ratio of the minor types of oxygen to the more common type of oxygen, is absolutely fundamental to our current understanding of how the solar system formed and how the planets formed and what processes were going on within the asteroids and planets. But what we really need is to know what the initial composition of the solar system was, and that's what we're going to get by measuring the oxygen from the solar wind, which came from the sun. Essentially, other than for hydrogen and helium, the composition of the sun is essentially unchanged since the formation of the solar system 4.5 billion years ago.
And obviously here, you're just talking about tiny, tiny amounts of element. Can you just give us an idea of the scale here, just how tiny these samples are, how accurate these experiments have to be?
In the case of carbon, we expect to get about 1/1,000,000th of a gram of carbon from somewhere between 10 and 20 square centimetres of collector material. And then we have to make a measurement of the two forms of carbon, the carbon-12 and the carbon-13 isotopes, to a precision of about 1 part in 1,000. So these are very high precision measurements.
And so, obviously, cleanliness is the big point here. You have to be absolutely sure that what you're looking at is definitely something that was collected in space and didn't just kind of find its way in as a contaminant back on Earth.
Yes, the atmosphere is full of dust, oxygen, nitrogen, carbon. We have to treat the samples incredibly carefully in ultra-clean labs, handling them with ultra-clean tools so we don't add anything else to the surface.
And this is obviously going to be a big moment for you. I mean, it's been a 3-year mission. These samples will have travelled millions of kilometres and they're going to end up in your hands and your colleagues' hands. How nervous will you be?
This is definitely the most nerve-wracking thing we'll be doing for a long time. And while the analysis may only be a 5-10 minute experiment, the build-up to that and the preparation will go on for many weeks on the particular samples, making sure the instrument is absolutely perfect before we put the sample anywhere near it.
Well, just before I leave the Open University, a final word with Colin Pillager. Now, this, Colin, is the first time since the 1970s that we are bringing material back from beyond the immediate confines of Earth, isn't it?
Yes, it's the last lunar materials were actually brought back by the Russians, not by NASA. But this is genuinely the first time that we have a documented sample coming back to our laboratories. It is really one of the most challenging samples that we could imagine because of this sensitivity of the instruments and contamination problems.
It's not just the Open University team who are in for a nerve-wracking time. Before they can have their sample of solar wind, there's the small matter of getting it safely back to Earth. For that job, NASA has hired 2 helicopter pilots who usually earn their living doing stunt flying for big Hollywood movies like The Incredible Hulk. But next Wednesday, they'll be taking off from the Utah desert to intercept the small capsule as it spirals down on its parachute, looking for all the world like a hang glider. En route to a final practice flight, pilot Dan Rudert spoke to us about what lay in store for him and his flying partner, Cliff Fleming, next week.
Once we finally see it, as we fly up to it, it's kind of like aerial ballet and flying formation, maybe with a giant floating jellyfish, if you will. And we have a hook on the end of an 18-foot pole on the bottom of the helicopter. And what we do is we overfly the center of the parachute and we catch it with this hook. And once we catch it on the hook, the line pays out and then it becomes a suspended load underneath the helicopter. For Cliff and I, we feel that almost one of the more difficult things for us to do is once it becomes a payload underneath this long line, we have to put it on a very precise spot and very gently. It would kind of defeat the point of us doing a mid-air recovery if we were to, you know, slam it into the ground or drag it across the desert floor. So that's actually one of the reasons that Cliff and I were brought onto this is we have a lot of helicopter experience.
You make it sound really easy. I'm sure it isn't.
Well, Cliff and I probably have close to 50 years of flying experience and just probably shy of 20,000 hours. But I think if you were to ask Cliff and I to do this 20 years ago, we probably would have been overwhelmed and in over our head. But this is still definitely a challenge. But we're doing so much practice with replica, you know, dummy payloads out here. And that's what we're doing today is we drop, a dummy payload from very high and we go and actually capture it. Pretty representative of how it's going to be for September 8th.
In all these practice runs, have you ever dropped it?
No. We've done 15 of these mid-air retrievals. And Cliff and I have had a 100% success rate. We've caught it on the first pass every time. So now that we've done that, no one wants to be the first one to miss it.
And the problem is, when you're working on movies, okay, you foul up, and maybe the producer's cross with you because you wasted some money. But if you foul up this time, there's an awful lot of money going down the pan, not to mention the precious sample.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing as you get to know some of these scientists and engineers, and it's just amazing they can even get it to where we catch it. But you see, a lot of it, it's their life's work. You want to make sure you catch it and bring it back. But you're right, in a movie you can yell cut or reset, but Genesis is only going to come back once and one time. And I think we'll be at a tentative fever pitch to make sure we catch it.
Stunt pilot Dan Rudert on his role in NASA's latest space adventure. One of the space agency's most successful missions was Voyager 1. Launched in 1977, it flew past the outer planets and is now leaving our solar system, heading out towards interstellar space. On board is a message, a record with the sounds of humanity and Earth engraved in its grooves.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Any extraterrestrials who find Voyager can listen to these sounds and perhaps learn a little about life on our planet. Now, that idea might seem a little quaint, especially in the week when there have been rumours that the SETI project, which is searching the skies for radio signals from alien civilizations, has detected something that could be the real thing. But Christopher Rose of Rutgers University in the United States thinks the Voyager team had the right idea. In a paper in the journal Nature this week, he argues that it really is better to send out an object rather than a radio signal if we want to communicate with aliens. Or they want to talk to us.
My particular take on it is that if they actually want to get more information, and I imagine that there's a lot of information to be given, radio is great for simple messages such as I am here, but may not be the best for large messages. And those sorts of large messages you might want to pack into essentially a little kit bag and literally, this is the funny part, toss it to the destination, even if the destination is tens of thousands of light years away.
You mean like a small space rocket or something like that? Just send it winging out into space and hope that somebody finds it?
Well, essentially, your rocket would probably have to be smarter, but the notion there would be you put it into a rocket, whatever the thing was, and it would have to be relatively dense information. It couldn't be written on papyrus scrolls, for example. That's not dense enough. You'd have to do things that are more computer age. Like a disk inside a computer might be enough density to get your information across in an efficient sort of fashion, and putting it into a ship and getting the ship to park itself somewhere near the destination to await recognition and discovery by the local denizens of whatever solar system you happen to send it to.
And why would that be so much better than radio waves? I mean, radio waves surely can go much, much further, much faster.
Yes, that's a wonderful question, because further and further and faster are great. Farther away, just like when you shine a flashlight beam somewhere, and the farther away the thing is that you're trying to illuminate gets dimmer and dimmer because the light disperses, radio does exactly the same thing. So that's bad for communications. The amount of data that you can get goes down. And then in addition, the other thing that I have to mention is that the energetics, meaning how much energy it takes to radiate a message of a certain size versus how much energy it takes to deliver a message of a certain size that's in some physical medium, the numbers are rather astounding. And that's why we wrote the paper. So imagine that you're trying to communicate with a star that's 10,000 light years away. So here's the analogy. Imagine the amount of energy that it takes to lift a 2-kilo pack of sugar from a countertop into a cabinet. We'll equate that with the amount of energy it takes to get a written message from Earth to 10,000 light years away. The corresponding amount of energy it would take having to radiate the same message to a point 10,000 light years away is about a 2-megaton nuclear blast. So these are huge differences.
So you mean it might be a more efficient use of energy to send a thing, an artifact, rather than loads of radio waves?
Certainly it's more efficient, at least that's what the physics says. The energy issue is really a surrogate for complexity. So the notion there that something that costs less energy is somehow easier to do, in a grand scale, that's something that doesn't change with the fad or the time. So that's why we consider energy as opposed to other things that might change with time. But these sorts of numbers make you really want to look at inscribed matter, information written down in a letter.
One of these packages that you can park somewhere and hope that another intelligent life form is going to find it. But aren't you then just hoping that they'll find it?
Certainly. And anytime you're radiating, you're kind of hoping that somebody will be listening. They may not exist at the time you're listening, so you have to, or may not have the technology to receive your message. So it's kind of the same problem no matter how you look at the medium that you use to transmit the message of whether they'll be there or not. Matter has the nice property that it persists where it is, and it happens to be energy efficient, which is, again, kind of nice.
That was Christopher Rose. If he's right, he reckons maybe the best places to look for a package to us from ET might be on the moon or floating out in the asteroid belt. But when it comes to terrestrial communication, I hope this radio broadcast has done the job. I'll be back on the airwaves next time, so I hope you can join me then. For now, from me, Dee Palmer, and the rest of the Science and Action team, goodbye.